Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This year's Jazz Fest poster was created by artist Terrence Osborne. Terrence welcomes us into his home studio and reveals the Louisiana elements that make his work so unique. For many, the Kentucky Derby's Run for the Roses begins with a well-crafted mint julep. Mixologist Chris McMillan waxes poetic about the qualities of this classic Southern cocktail and teaches us exactly how it's made. You won't want to miss a minute of this week's Louisiana Eats. The artist palette of Terrence Osborne is as vividly delectable and diverse as Louisiana itself. You may have perused his art at previous Jazz and Heritage festivals, but this year, Terrence is the artist of the official, highly sought-after annual poster. Terrence, thank you for welcoming us into your home studio.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me, Poppy. I appreciate it.
So tell me, how many years have you been involved at the festival?
Well, I think this is about my 12th year.
Oh, my
11th,
gosh.
Maybe.
That's a long time.
Yeah. I've been around for a while.
So you must have been very young when you started doing the festival.
Oh, yeah. I was a baby. I mean, I think, I was in college when I started doing the festival. I would go and see Richard Thomas, who's a local artist here. And I loved the way he sold his artwork and the way he was in the media. And I wanted that.
So he's your inspiration.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah,
he's part of your inspiration.
Yeah, he's one of the vets over there. He's been at it 30 years plus.
And what's the experience of the festival like for you?
Well, it's almost like a big reunion. Every year, some of the same faces come around and then some new faces. But it's just a big party. Everybody's feeling good and sharing and...
And you're always located in the same place on the fairgrounds, aren't you?
Usually, yeah.
So where can we find you then?
In Congo Square.
Ah, yes. Yeah. So you've done the Congo Square Festival posters previously. Mm-hmm. What years did you do those?
Well, the Congo Square poster I did in 2007 and 2010. There's a little bit of a gap between the posters and years, but they are the only Jazz Fest posters that are a series, because if you connect the two posters, there's a house that continues on to the next one. So it's great.
That was a great idea. Mm-hmm. Well, everybody who goes to the festival knows that the food at the festival itself is an art. And since you are a festival artist, you practically live there during the 7 days the festival's going on.
Oh, yeah.
So what's the first thing you eat?
The first thing I eat is the mango freeze.
You love that one.
Gotta have a mango freeze. I mean, we probably have, between my wife and I, we have about 10 each before the festival's over.
And what else? What else sustains you during festival?
The crawfish bread is amazing. There's somebody who sells it who is just the best. I mean, you know it when you have it. Plantains.
Oh, yeah.
Those are wonderful.
And the Jamma Jamma. You can't eat the plantains without the Jamma Jamma.
Of course.
But tell me, what inspires your art?
Well, color, definitely. There's really two different inspirations for me. One, it has to do with the content, and that's more of something that I was born into. You know, before I realized what New Orleans was, I was already expressing the culture. And I think that's true for a lot of locals here who are talented and project that. You're born into it, and then eventually you get around to expressing it and then realizing it and then appreciating it because you've been in it the whole time. I think the other thing is the color. We're vibrant and energetic and eccentric people, and we love our culture, and the color is a great expression of it. You know, we're not afraid to paint our houses purple and green or pink and brown. It's easy to find it anywhere in the city. So I don't know. It just feels kind of natural to use any color.
So Terrence, as steeped in New Orleans culture as you were growing up, did you have to leave New Orleans to get perspective on that?
Well, I had a little bit of understanding of the culture pre-Katrina, but leaving the city gave me an entirely different perspective. We moved to Georgia. So we stayed in Georgia for almost 3 years, I believe.
3 years?
Almost, yeah. And yeah, that was a long time. And I almost got settled. Because in Georgia, we stayed in an area where the trees changed. You know, you don't see that in the city. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back to the city, I realized what I missed. And the people, you know, how everybody talks to you in New Orleans. We have a sense that everybody's family. Like, you know somebody through somebody else, you know. And so that I think that's why we talk to each other so freely here. You don't get that in most other places.
What drew you back?
Well, that's what drew me back. I missed that. You know, I realized that I'd hardened up. And when I came back, I was reminded of how I am supposed to be. So that was like the deciding factor. We had to come back.
Well, We're all really glad that you did. Now, we met each other last fall at a food event. And one of the thoughts that you shared with me is that in your paint colors, you see food sometimes and correlations to that. Would you talk to me about that?
Sure. A culinary artist, when they make their meal, mix all of these different foods or ingredients, and then they play around with temperatures and stuff to get the food to do what they want to do. I do the same thing with my artwork. When I'm mixing my paint, I know where I want to go with my color. And eventually I create something that is visually appealing. And it has the same visual appeal that food has. It almost looks edible when I'm done.
Well, let's talk about your coffee-inspired artwork.
Sure, sure. Well, French Market Coffee and Gallery Osborne partnered to come up with a poster to promote their new image. So I thought, okay, I'm a coffee tea drinker. It's easy. And what I did was I made a cup of coffee at the base of this vertical piece, and there's steam rising up all the way to the top. And in the steam, it reveals the whole city. There's icons, like iconic images, like the St. Louis Cathedral, a guy with an umbrella doing the second line dance, the streetcar, a magnolia, and a whole bunch of other symbols. And
it's crawfish. There's crawfish in
yeah,
there.
There's a crawfish, yeah. And a crawfish coming out of coffee, right?
Why not?
You know, it makes sense.
Doing this year's Jazz Fest poster is really a huge landmark occasion. Mm-hmm. What inspired that work? And talk to us about this year's poster.
Sure. Well, this year's poster is called Porch Song, and the artist that I've painted is Trombone Shorty. Everybody knows about Trombone Shorty's success. You know, he's a young guy. I believe he's like 25. We're 10 years apart.
Yeah.
He's traveling all over the world. So this is his time to get recognized. Grew up right in Treme, and so did I. So when I painted the poster, it was easy to paint Shorty because I knew I wanted to put him in the Treme neighborhood. Now, it's a generic Treme neighborhood. There are no streets that are recognizable. But while Shorty is blowing his horn, the neighborhood is bending to his note. And so that's the whole feel. The buildings look kind of warped. So he's on a porch. There's also a little T and S with a heart around it right on the bricks on the porch that I usually will throw something in there that is personal to me. So Terrence and Stephanie.
Oh, it's like a little love letter.
Yeah, yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun.
So how do you want people to view your art? What do you want your art to mean to people?
Well, I want people to look at my art and be overwhelmed. I like to throw colors together that feel good to me. So when I'm done with my piece, I want my spectator to look at it without me even being there and feel what I felt while I was working on it. To me, that exchange is priceless.
Well, I am a big fan, and it was really thrilling to have this opportunity to find the artist in his studio at home. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Poppy. I appreciate it.
Terrence Osborne, creator of this year's Jazz and Heritage Festival poster. And now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The answer to this week's question, what crawfish dish is considered by many to be endangered, is crawfish bisque. With at least 3 stuffed crawfish heads in every cup-sized serving, hours of work are involved in the preparation, and time is often today's rarest commodity. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, for the first time ever, our inbox had more entries from out-of-state residents than it did locally. That's why our prize is headed north to Wisconsin. Congratulations to Sally Marks of Milwaukee for her winning entry, and a big thank you to everyone else out there who participated in this week's quiz.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what steaming Louisiana beverage has occasionally appeared in Terrence Osborne's art? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at wwno.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what steaming Louisiana beverage has occasionally appeared in Terrence Osborne's art? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to Louisiana Eats at wwno.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Chris McMillan is a 19th century bartender living in a 21st century world. His love and understanding for classic cocktails is like none other, but perhaps Chris is most closely associated with the classic mint julep. Chris, thanks so much for coming to visit us. Well,
thank you for having me.
Chris, would you walk us through the classic preparation of the julep?
Absolutely. You need just a couple of essential items, preferably a metal cup, silver if possible. Well, and if you don't have that, a Collins-style glass that's thin so it'll more efficiently radiate away the heat from the glass. You need some beautiful fresh mint, crushed ice, and a good bourbon. I take my metal glass, put a small quantity of simple syrup in the bottom of the glass, which is an equal mixture of water and granulated sugar mixed and shaken together until dissolved. You don't have to heat it. It'll dissolve in a matter of seconds. That's why they call it simple. We put just a little bit in the bottom of the glass and then take a large handful of mint and squeeze it in your hand so that you just release those oils, and then drop it into the bottom of the glass. Take a muddler and just gently rub the mint against the sides of the glass, touching all of the surfaces. And the small amount of simple syrup we placed in there acts as an adhesive. So it holds the mint all over the interior of the glass, distributing the oil evenly. And then you fill it up with as much crushed ice as you can get into it, and even a couple of inches above the glass, making a tall cone like a snow cone. Because when you hit it with that room temperature alcohol, the volume of the ice is going to subside dramatically and rapidly. So if you want it to be filled, you need to overfill it with ice. And then you just pour the simple syrup after having gotten the bourbon in there. Pour the simple syrup over it, and sweetness is a matter of preference. The beauty of the drink is its simplicity, and it's about the bourbon, the mint, the sugar, and the ice, and nothing else.
What makes a drink a julep?
Julep was a Persian word, and it meant rose water. If we ever go to places like Limona's or Lebanon's Cafe, and we have their Lebanese iced tea, which is a rose water flavored tea, it's kind of the concept. It very early on comes to mean a flavored syrup, and those syrups were used in connection with medicinal compounds. And inherent in the word julep is a tonic effect, and you had different kinds of juleps dependent upon what tonic effect you were seeking. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, if you will, and by the beginning of the 19th century, julep takes on a dual role, you know, one as this medicinal tonic and the other as a recreational beverage, and it maintains this dual meaning. It was the first drink to popularize the use of ice. Historically, what the martini was to the 20th century, the julep was to the 19th century as the quintessential American beverage.
That is so interesting. And I noticed that you don't stir a julep.
The julep, there are very few drinks that have the quality of being multidimensional, that when you start it, it tastes one way. When you finish it, it tastes a different way. Because of the different densities of the ingredients, you have water from the ice, you have alcohol from the bourbon, you have sugar from the syrup. Each one of those things has a different weight. And so as the drink settles and as the drink dilutes, those flavors have different intensities at different levels. And so the deeper you get into it, the mintier it's going to become, the sweeter it's going to become. I tell people when having their julep for the first time, when you first drink it, you're going to say, oh my God, can I drink this? It's going to be the biggest, stiffest shot of bourbon you ever had. But if you get to about right here, and that's about two-thirds of the way down the drink, it starts to have diluted and softened up a little bit, becomes a little mintier, a little bit sweeter. And by the time you get to the end of it, you're going to wish it'll never end. It's really a lovely thing.
Well, it sounds to me like all of those people who you see stirring madly in their silver cups, trying to get that icy outside, are really doing the drink inside an injustice.
If you want to make the exterior of the cup frost, it needs to be dry. If it's wet, it won't frost. But if it's dry, it will. And so that's really, it's, again, a matter of technique and understanding of the process.
Would you elaborate for me on the different treatments of the mint and what you're doing and why?
Mint is a delicate herb. And your object is not to crush the herb, but to release the oil, the perfume of the mint itself. And that doesn't require extensive manipulation. I use probably five times the mint that most people use. And by using more mint, it requires less manipulation to produce more oil. If you over-extract the mint, all plants, the green is chlorophyll, which is bitter. And if you over-extract the mint, you will add bitter flavors to the drink. You can hide it in a mint julep under the robust, intense flavors of bourbon. But a mojito, on the contrast, same principle, is often ruined by bartenders who think they're demonstrating their skill to you by showing you their muddling technique. And by over-extracting the mint, they're releasing those bitter flavors, and it destroys the drink. And, you know, I mean, its essence is rum, sugar, mint, club soda. Almost the same. In fact, you could even say that a mojito is probably influenced by the mint julep, you know, and an evolution of the Cuban expression of the mint julep within the context of their culture and their indigenous ingredients.
Why is the mint julep so closely tied to horse racing?
Well, it originally came from Virginia. All of what we now call Kentucky was once part of Bourbon County, Virginia. Kentuckians don't widely like to acknowledge this.
Okay.
But the thing that makes Kentucky a great place for horses, the thing that makes Kentucky a great place for the production of whiskey, is its natural geology. It's limestone, which is a natural occurring material. It's calcium that's decayed through the eons, and the water, the rain, filters through that calcium substrata. Well, I'm not a geologist, so I don't have the correct terms there, but it softens the water and makes it calcium rich. Calcium makes big, strong bones, which make for great horse races, that makes the bluegrass blue. And wherever you make whiskey, you must have large amounts of water and the right kind of it. So that's the reason why Scotland is also one of the great whiskey producing regions of the world, is because of its water.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for treating all of the Louisiana Eats audience to the classic mint julep.
Well, that's very sweet of you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you, Chris. Chris McMillan, 19th century bartender, known for his delicious mint julep.
One early morning, as I was walking, I met a woman who started talking. I took her home to get a few nips, but all I had was mint julep. One mint julep was the cause of it all.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, author Kit Wall and classic New Orleans brunches.
As everyone knows, there's the huge Brennan family. They started Breakfast at Brennan's in retaliation in the 40s because an author here published a book entitled Dinner at Antoine's. Well, Mr. Brennan thought, well, this won't do. I need to create an event. That's a good idea.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lightsegan Funeral Homes, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cooking Magazine. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.